from 90.1 WFYI Public Radio. Welcome to The Art of the Matter, made possible by the ongoing support of listeners like you.
Hello and welcome to The Art of the Matter. I'm Travis DiNicola. The music for today's show is courtesy of the Baselli Walrab Jazz Orchestra from their Heart and Soul album, available through Owl Studios at owlstudios.com.
And I'm Sharon Gamble. Today I'll catch up with the Indianapolis Women's Chorus.
I'll find out what is on the Indiana Humanities bookshelf.
And I'll talk with Dan Carpenter about his new collection of poems, and we'll have the arts calendar we call
What'll We Do? All that and more right after the latest news from NPR. Indianapolis Women's Chorus has its fall concert coming up on November 21st and 22nd. It's called With One Voice, and Sharon Gamble invited the chorus's new artistic director, Megan Johnson, and board member, singer Marty Miles, to our studio to learn about it.
So, Megan, you've been with choral music for a while. How did you get involved in music in the first place and then get involved in voice?
Sure. I think music has just been part of my life. I started picking out things on the piano when I was about 4 years old, and so my parents started me in piano lessons, and from there I sang in children's choirs at church and in choirs at school. And as I was, you know, approaching career decision time, what should I study in college, I was thinking, maybe I'll be a biologist, maybe I'll do this, and I thought, I've always done music. That's the thing that has always been here. And so I went into music education and voice performance. I have done various things wearing various hats at various times. Mm-hmm. So, but I always keep coming back to choirs. There's something really special to me about people singing together.
Were there other musicians in your family? Siblings or your parents?
My
musical?
Sister is also a professional musician. She's more of a pianist than
wow.
I am. She's younger, though, so I was a little bit of the trailblazer. My parents were both amateur musicians, and it was really nice to see that after my sister and I both became involved in music, they joined a chorus and started to get more involved in their own musical activities.
Good, good. You're a trendsetter. And Marty, how did you come to be involved with music?
I, too, was in music most of my life. I took piano lessons when I was six and sang in a cappella choirs in high school, sang in some church choirs. I went for a while without music for about 10 years.
Oh, and, that must have been hard.
It was really hard, and I think it's going without music that you realize, oh, my gosh, this is just part of who I am and what I need as a creative expression. And so that's why I joined the Indianapolis Women's Chorus.
So there's there is something that's almost at a chemical or a biological level that happens when people make music together. And it seems like that's even more so when your instrument is the voice as opposed to, say, a French horn or a clarinet. Can you figure out why that is? Can you articulate why that is?
I have some ideas. There have actually been some wonderful studies recently.
Really?
One showing that members of a choir, the actual hearts of members of a choir began to beat synchronously as the choir was singing.
No.
Isn't that amazing? So I have some ideas about it. I think one of them is that when you're in a choir, you are all breathing together.
Mm-hmm.
You all have to take breaths at relatively the same time in order to be singing the same phrases of music. And so I think that just the natural action of the breathing mechanism starts to bring our bodies into sync with one another. But I also think that the mental process of attention to music and the mental process, mental, emotional, spiritual process of focusing on a common goal or outcome of singing a song, of singing in tune even, you know, just tuning one note, really brings us onto the same page. I won't I wanted to say wavelength, and that seems a little bit sort of woo-woo. But I think I think really there is a strong biological and physiological component to it, and I think there's also a mental component of focus in the mind and body together.
Do you ever have a time, and I'm going to ask this of both of you with different hats on, Marty as a singer, Megan, I know you also sing, but sure. As a conductor, do you ever have an experience where you come to rehearsal and you're just not in the same space as everybody else? And if that happens, what do you do?
When you're not in the same space.
Not literally, but I mean, yes. You're having trouble with that focus.
I think one of the things, and Megan mentioned this, is some of the warm-up kinds of activities that we do, I think, allow us, again, to be present to our bodies. Mm. It starts with just being present to what we're feeling in our bodies and our feet being on the ground. And it's a sense of being in the moment, which has helped me leave whatever it was that I brought in at the door. Mm. And that's helped me be present to this is what we're doing right now. And then when you add those voices, even though we're all different kinds of voices, the effort to create a note and then the effort to express a story that's in a song, I think helps me get out of where I was and helps me be present and mm-hmm. be in the same place.
It's kind of like a meditation that you look forward
absolutely.
To.
Absolutely.
Do you've probably had to kind of diplomatically herd those cats occasionally, right?
Yes, herding cats is, it's not taught explicitly in music school, but I think it's something you learn. So the warm-up process, I intentionally create opportunities for people to do exactly what Marty was just saying, to use their breath in a way to release tension from their thinking, from their bodies, whatever they came to rehearsal with, and to start to synchronize with one another and bring their attention to the present moment and the present activity, which is singing. And so yesterday, for example, we had rehearsal and I was feeling a little frazzled. That happens to me as the conductor.
Sure.
And I said, we're just going to start with three long out breaths. And I talked them through a particular process of attention to the breath. And we did three out breaths together. And what do you know, by the time we were done with three, I was calmer, which is good, number one. And then I could sense a change in the chorus, that everyone was more present and more grounded and more focused. And from there, we could begin the process of warming up the voice, making sure that we were using our breath well in the high range and the low range and the middle, and to also tune into our listening, because our first job as choral musicians is actually to listen. Our second job is to breathe, and the third job is to make sound. So,
when you have background and training in Alexander technique,
I do.
And some of our listeners might be a little familiar with that. Tell us how that helps you as a conductor.
Absolutely. So the Alexander technique is mind-body education for release of tension and improved performance in whatever you do. Mm-hmm. I use it as a musician, but lots of people use it who are not musicians. And for me, that gives me really concrete skills for releasing tension that I have been holding, of being aware of what I'm doing, and then having a choice. Do I want to keep using this tension? Is it helping me? Mm. Or is there another choice I could make to be able to do what I'm doing with more ease, with more freedom? And it has been absolutely invaluable in my own singing and in my work as a conductor, and I apply it directly to how I give instructions in rehearsal and how I pace rehearsal. So I would say it informs most of what I do.
Is there ever a time in singing, preparing to sing, preparing your singers, when creating tension is advantageous?
Sure. So I like to differentiate between the words tension and tone. I think most people are used to the word like muscle tone. We want a balanced muscle tone. Mm-hmm. For example, we're singing a song from the American Civil Rights era. And if we sing that with just kind of like a relaxed, oh, I'm just having a stroll down the street. It really doesn't convey the message and intention of the song. And by creating some by energizing our bodies, we are able to create the vocal tone that supports that song and create the sort of mental emotional space that helps us to tell that story of that particular struggle and why it's still relevant today.
And I think Megan has had us experience that physically, both with that song and some other songs where we have literally sung the same song, walking, you know, mm-hmm. marching mm-hmm. by the beat, 1, 2, 3, 4, and it feels like a march and it sounds like a march, as opposed to a intentional kind of forceful but smooth walk. It's an entirely different piece. And so I think she's helped us bring that sense of helpful tension and creative to the creative process.
Sure. So let's say there's a brand new piece. Nobody in the chorus has heard it. Maybe it's something you've written for this sure. ensemble. Where do you start? Do you start with technique? Do you start with emotional intent? Do you start with meaning of words? Do you start where? Or is it different depending on what the piece is?
It's absolutely different depending on what the piece is. For me, I like to start with sort of a global view first, talking about what the piece is, if there's a way for us to experience that musically, whether it's to sort of sight read or to learn just the melody, something that we can experience. This is a whole of the piece. And then we start to break it down into smaller pieces to work on. And for me, it's really important that singers know what the whole is to which each part is contributing. I am a composer, and when I have introduced new works that I've written to other choruses, I haven't written anything specifically for Indie Women's yet.
Too soon. Give it time.
Yeah, maybe for the next concert.
There you go.
You know, as the composer, I have the advantage of having crafted the piece, so I know how it's put together. When I'm working with a piece of music that I haven't written, it's my job to study that piece of music and know how it's crafted so that I can introduce it intelligently to the singers so that it's approachable and accessible. So, you know, I'll find one section maybe that we can learn and have some immediate success in singing, but also talk about what's the cultural background, what's the poem, who was the poet if it's someone else's words, what's the point? Mm-hmm. Why are we giving our bodies, minds, and voices to this piece of music? Why are we doing that?
Tell us more about the November concert.
Sure. So the November concert is titled With One Voice, and the concert is a way of celebrating the power of women's voices when they are raised together. And I think that's something that is really important for not only the Indianapolis Women's Chorus, but women's choruses in general. So we're singing music from around the world. I have a strong dedication to and love for world music. Mm-hmm. And so we are singing a piece from South Africa in the Xhosa language that is an anti-HIV AIDS song. We are singing this song from the American Civil Rights era. We are singing two wedding songs in celebration of marriage equality, one from Norway and one from the Republic of Georgia. We're singing a piece by a contemporary American composer named Abby Batinas, whose works have been performed in Indianapolis before. Let's see, what else are we doing? So
she's doing this without notes, folks. I'm impressed. And probably in order of the program.
And we're singing a piece written by... now I'm going to blank. By Dr. Bernice Johnson Regan, who is one of the founders of Sweet Honey in the Rock.
Right.
And we're singing Ella's song, which is was written by Dr. Regan in honor of Ella Baker, who was a civil rights leader. And so we're bringing lots of different threads together. Oh, and we're also singing the title piece of the concert, One Voice, which is a song by the Waylon Jennies, a Canadian folk trio. So we're trying to come at this question of what does it mean to sing with one voice from a lot of different angles, musically, culturally, philosophically. We're also doing a deep listening meditation by Pauline Oliveros, who is a groundbreaking American woman composer. And so you will hear sounds that you may never have had an opportunity to hear before at this concert. We'll be singing in four languages.
Yes.
We're also singing a traditional Sephardic Jewish song from Spain. And so there's a lot of diversity. I really think something that everyone will enjoy. You know, if you don't like this one, you will like the next one. You know, so I love diverse concerts because they can showcase the ability of the singers to sing with lots of different timbres, with lots of different vocal tones and vocal colors, and also give the singers an opportunity to express lots of different things. One song we're singing about, we must come together to do something about the HIV crisis. And another song we're singing, a beautiful woman has just walked into the hall. Who needs a candle when the woman shines so brightly? I mean, so we have all of these different pieces and they all fit together thematically in the idea of having one voice.
Sharon Gamble with Indianapolis Women's Chorus, new artistic director Megan Johnson, and board member and singer Marty Miles. You can hear With One Voice on Saturday, November 21st at 7:30 and Sunday the 22nd at 3 o'clock at the Unitarian Universalist Church of Indianapolis. Find out more and get your tickets by searching for Indianapolis Women's Chorus on Facebook.
You're listening to The Art of the Matter on WFYI 90.1 FM Public Radio. The next Indiana bookshelf is not exactly a shelf, but it is a collection of 13 books that Indiana Humanities is going to help put on the shelves of libraries, schools, and other groups to celebrate Indiana's bicentennial. Travis DiNicola spoke with Leah Namias, Director of Programs and Community Engagement for Indiana Humanities, about the project.
Leah, welcome to Art of the Matter. Great to have you here.
Thank you. I'm so glad to be here.
Absolutely. This is a really cool project that Indiana Humanities, once known as Indiana Humanities Council, has put together. The bookshelf, 13 books that are going to go in all sorts of very cool places all over the state with lots of programs attached to it. But let's start with, how did this come about? Because this is actually, it's something tied to the bicentennial celebration, right?
That's right. So it's a program we're calling the Next Indiana Bookshelf. Mm-hmm. And it's a partnership between Indiana Humanities and the Indiana Center for the Book, which is, for folks who don't know, a center that's kind of housed at the state library.
Right.
And the mission of, you know, the Center for the Book is to, you know, celebrate love of reading among Hoosiers all over the state. For Indiana Humanities, our, you know, we talk about our work in terms of encouraging Hoosiers to think, read, and talk.
Mm-hmm.
And we've been thinking a lot about what's our role going to be for the bicentennial in 2016. And we've really felt like the space that we want to create for conversation is really around, you know, who are we today and where are we headed? Who are we coming? Which is why we're talking about the next Indiana.
Sure.
We feel like there's a lot of amazing organizations and folks who are kind of doing the work of looking back 200 years, but where there's space is to be thinking about the future. So what are the tools that we have in the humanities are things like books, things like conversation, and getting people to read and be thinking about ideas that help them think about their communities today as well as the future. So all of those kind of things were swirling in the ether when we started to put together a collaboration with the State Library and the Center for the Book called the Next Indiana Bookshelf.
I will mention Suzanne Walker from the State Library and Indiana Center for the Book was on Art of the Matter recently talking about their the map of Indiana authors that's being put out, as well as some other things. Really interesting project there that's also connected with the National Center for the Book as well. But great stuff that the State Library does. And so go on.
That's exactly right. So Next Indiana Bookshelf is a set of books that libraries, schools, community organizations can actually apply for.
Mm-hmm.
We'll send you the bookshelf. We'll send you 13 titles for your collection to use as the basis of programming throughout 2016 and beyond to get Hoosiers to think, read, and talk about the present and future of Indiana. We chose books, more contemporary titles. You know, there's no James Wickham Riley or The Hoosier Schoolmaster,
sure,
or some kind of those classic titles associated with Indiana.
No Booth Tarkington. It's not a greatest hits of the past.
Exactly right. Okay. And, you know, frankly, first of all, lots of folks have those in their collection. And as we've started to receive applications, people are saying what's neat about this project is that this will complement the kind of historical collections we already have.
Mm-hmm.
So it's 13 titles. There are fiction, there's nonfiction, there are essay collections, there's even poetry on there.
Mm-hmm.
We've chosen some titles that work for adults as well as kids and teens. And all of the books are either written by a Hoosier author or they are set in Indiana,
mm-hmm,
in some way or another, both nonfiction. It's always weird to say set in Indiana when you're talking about nonfiction. It took, mm-hmm, place in Indiana, right? And there's a couple of classics. Rain Tree County is on there, in part because Suzanne Walker at the State Library is probably that book's fiercest proponent since
she's
my grandmother.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, exactly. But most of them are contemporary works, lesser known. And they all kind of really explore issues that are really kind of shaping Hoosier communities today. So just as an example of some of the topics that are explored throughout the bookshelf,
mm-hmm,
you know, there's a book on there that's really about three. It's called Soldier Girls by Helen Thorpe.
Mm-hmm.
It's a New York Times bestseller. And it's about three Hoosier women who served in the National Guard who sign up before September 11th, and then basically spend the next 12 years in and out of military service. And we picked that book because we wanted to help Hoosiers think about the fact that we have a new generation of veterans who are, mm-hmm, returning to our communities, how their experiences in and out of the military are, you know, they're bringing those with them back into their communities, and how communities can be more aware of both the, you know, the sacrifice and the service of these folks, as and how we're thinking about how these folks will shape the future of Indiana. So I'm very excited to include a book like that. Even though it's not by an Indiana author, it really tells the story of,
sure,
three Hoosier women and, by extension, many other folks who've served in the military.
I think there's a couple really interesting choices on here. I like that the letters of Kurt Vonnegut that were edited by Dan Wakefield is included. Instead of having one of Dan's books or Kurt's books on there, it kind of gets both of them in there and a different look at especially sort of the writer's process. And I know that within those letters, there's a lot of some interesting sort of commentary on what it means to grow up in Indiana and leave Indiana and such. So
that's exactly right. So we got to buy one, get one free because we have a volume by Vonnegut and edited by Dan Wakefield, and we get Kurt Vonnegut talking about what it means to be a Middle Westerner, that's his phrase,
mm-hmm,
you know, what it was like to be from Indiana, his ongoing connection with Indiana. That's a story I relate to as someone who's from Indiana,
mm-hmm,
grew up in Greensburg, left the state for 10 years and moved back last year. We have a couple of titles that I think, not just Kurt Vonnegut, a kind of a fictional title that I think also explores a similar theme of how we feel connected or not, whether or not we live here, and what are those roots and ties that pull us back to Indiana,
sure,
is What This River Keeps by Greg Schwipps. And so this is the story of, you know, another type of Hoosier story. It's a story of a family who is about to lose their bottomland farm to eminent domain. You know,
mm-hmm,
it's, the case is being made that this is in the public interest. It's some older parents and their son who has to decide, am I going to come back to Indiana, and what's my relationship to my family's legacy and the land? I also think it helps us think about issues around, you know, the public interest versus private interests. And I think these are things that Hoosiers think about and want opportunities to talk about as a community as they think about our present and our future.
Very cool. You know, a couple on here that I was, of course, very pleased to see, the Essential Etheridge Knight, gathering Etheridge Knight's works, which are just fantastic. The poetry that started writing as first a prisoner at the Indiana State Prison. Also Susan Neville, who's just an amazing writer, a professor at Butler. Her book, Sailing the Island Sea, looking at writing and literature and land and sort of looking at how writers talk about the Hoosier landscape.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, those are, you know, ones that were like, oh, awesome. And then I was surprised by this one. So John Green's Paper Towns. I wasn't surprised John Green was on there.
Well, there you go.
But my first thought was, but why wouldn't it be Fault in Our Stars, which is set in Indianapolis?
Well, so one reason is just a sense of overfamiliarity with that title. It's been,
yep,
and kind of a sense of, you know, could we try to have a selection that might surprise a few more people? I think we,
sure,
you know, tried. This is, I will say, it is a hard thing to find the exact perfect set. But as we were having our conversation,
I can't even imagine what you guys.
It's a lot of fun. I shouldn't complain. I actually enjoy it.
Like hundreds of note cards and like, what about this author? Well,
yeah,
we
look
this,
like those crazy conspiracy theorists and everything. So
it's a tough thing to do. I certainly recognize that.
Yeah. So with John Green, I think we were, first of all, I wanted a book that kind of explored suburban existence. And that is something that there aren't, as to my knowledge, really good books that really are set in a place that most people live these days. And so I wanted a book that could kind of do that and kind of, you know, both kind of the imagined landscape of suburbia as well as the actual kind of what it's like to live there, even though that book is set in Florida. It's an Indian author. So like you said, John Green felt like a good, that's kind of the problem, right? So that was kind of one of the things we wanted to have. I think The Fault in Our Stars felt a little bit overfamiliar. We started talking about this last year. I mean, so that was one kind of thing pushing us in that direction. And I think there was also just a feeling on the committee that was selecting this. This is just a book that they all kind of personally liked a lot more. Mm-hmm. And just the kind of more melodramatic elements of The Fault in Our Stars, we were like, meh, let's steer it in a different direction. So,
well, interesting choice. Yeah. No, well, absolutely. And then and that's the thing.
Feel free to agree or disagree. But yeah, it was.
And that's part of the discussion as well, right?
Well, and I think like that actually is. So you imagine here are books, they sit on a shelf. People might read them individually and have personal reflection. But also, you know, through Indiana Humanities Novel Conversations Program, which is a free statewide lending library of book sets, these titles will be available as book sets that book groups and classrooms can borrow for free from us to have conversations. And so you want to imagine what are the conversations that we might have around these texts. And so something like Paper Towns and thinking about, you know, there's a lot of different issues that come into play in that book, but we can imagine the kinds of conversations. What does this say about us? Is this what we would want literature to depict Hoosiers as? And what do we think about that? That was kind of what we were going for.
One book I was delighted to see on there, which some people may say, oh, well, is that a little self-serving? But it is the Food for Thought book, which was published by Indiana Humanities. But this is an absolutely stunning, beautiful book. It came out about 2 years ago. David Hoppe wrote the book, interviews and sort of features on all different types of people involved with Indiana food and agriculture, chefs, farmers, what have you. Beautiful photographs by Kristen Hess, and just a stunning book. And it's a book that I think more people should see and know about. And so I'm glad to see it being carried out there on the bookshelf through this project.
Well, Travis, we completely agree. So glad and so kind of you to say that about Food for Thought. So yeah, we were, one of the things that I think is really important for Hoosiers today and as we think about the future is what's our relationship to our agricultural past? Mm-hmm. How are people reimagining and rethinking not only agriculture and food, but how we use our land generally? And I think there are several titles here. We have a Susan Neville, right? We have the Greg Schwipps book, which is about eminent domain and a bottomland farm. There's also Scott Russell Sanders, exactly.
Scott Russell Sanders,
and his essay is about our connections to land and place. So I think that's a theme that's throughout the bookshelf because it's an important theme in Indiana. But Food for Thought is both, it's an exciting story about Indiana. We're living through an incredible moment of change in food and agriculture, people thinking creatively about reinventing food and agriculture, as well as people who are, you know, fifth, sixth generation farmers. And those stories are included and collected in Food for Thought. It's a beautiful book. And so we saw this as an opportunity to share that more widely and make sure that this was a basis of conversation for Hoosiers as we're living through our bicentennial.
Very cool. So how can people apply? I mean, how many of these do you have to give out, essentially?
That's a great question. So we have funding, thanks to a grant that we got through the State Library, to provide 55 sets of these books. Okay. And they will be there. There's a simple application on the Indiana Humanities website, indianahumanities.org, for folks to fill out telling us about, you know, why they'd like to use these books as part of their bicentennial celebration and programming. Tell us a little bit about their community and how they'll play out. I mean, I will say just as an aside, it's been fun to read those. So we see, for instance, with Food for Thought, people in rural communities talking about working with their, you know, Purdue Extension agents to do programming around the future of food. And anyway, so that aside, there's a simple website that's open through November 23rd. We'll be making, there'll be a committee that makes decisions. We're going to try to make sure that we have great representation in different types of communities all across the state. the books themselves are also oftentimes things that folks might have in their collections already if you're at a library or a school. We have book plates that folks can just use to kind of label and mark these books and pull them out during the bicentennial. One of the other things I'm really excited about is that a special chant was written by children's author April Polisaire, who's based up in South Bend, for the bicentennial. It's called the Indiana Chant. She wrote it for the bicentennial. It's not necessarily being published as a book. So what we did is we designed a poster with the chant on it, and every library and every school in Indiana will get a copy of that poster, and we have additional copies that folks can request from us. So we're really excited about the Indiana chant as an example of getting out to truly every corner of the state. 55 sets of the books will be available. And then we also have free lending library of book sets from selections from the next Indiana bookshelf.
Excellent. Excellent. Leah, thank you so much for coming into Art of the Matter. I'm looking forward to filling up my bookshelf with some of the titles that I don't already have.
Well, thank you. And I definitely encourage Hoosiers to celebrate the bicentennial through reading and conversation.
Travis DiNicola with Leah Namias, Director of Programs and Community Engagement for Indiana Humanities. For more information about the next Indiana bookshelf and to apply to receive a free set of these books, visit indianahumanities.org. By the way, the deadline for applications is November 23rd. Once again, deadline November 23rd. Hey, Travis.
Yes, Sharon.
You know, I think somebody ate all the Reese's cups out of that bowl. What's still left in that leftover Halloween candy over there?
Brown no peanuts.
Oh, well, there might still be enough in there to give us energy to do some of the arts events that we have on our calendar.
Oh, here's a payday bar.
Yeah. Oh, there. Oh, perfect. Perfect.
We call?
What do we do? With leftover boo.
Boo. Hey, you know, a couple weeks ago, I had the pleasure of going out to the Sugar Creek Arts Center in Thorntown in Boone County, which is just a gorgeous building that is a really cool space that has been turned into an arts center there. They have studios for artists. They have classrooms. They have some small galleries. They have a larger gallery space. They have gift shops. And they do lots of cool events there. And for November at the Creek on the 13th and 14th, they're having their Artist Bazaar on both days. Friday night from 6 to 8, Culture at the Creek plus the Artist Bazaar, including the Unzickers Pottery. And then Saturday, 9 to 5 all day, the Artist Bazaar with Unzickers Pottery again. And they've got some artists from Henry County and paintings shown for Marvin Marlowe historical painting, and lots of other cool stuff that's going on up there, which is really worth checking out. Just a short drive, some great ideas for Christmas. Also, they are doing a class, a Mom and Me painting class called Mama Owl, Little Owl on Saturday the 21st, and it's $40 per pair of moms and their little kids to create two canvases with a mama owl and a little owl, which sounds delightful.
That.
Yeah, so you can check out more information if you Google them, Sugar Creek Art Center in Thorntown.
If you're a gardener, you're probably busy trying to beat the weather to get your last tasks in, cut back those perennials and mulch the leaves up and so forth. So here's something to pay attention to this Sunday at 2 o'clock. That's the 15th at 2 o'clock at the Toby over at the Indianapolis Museum of Art is a free talk called The Right Size Flower Garden. Simplify your outdoor space with smart design solutions and plant choices. And it's going to show you how to choose high-value plants and make simple design changes to get more beauty out of less work. And what gardener doesn't want to do that? That's this Sunday at 2 o'clock in the Toby, free. While you're there, go check out the Gustav Baumann exhibit, which is spectacular. I've seen it twice already.
Have you really?
The class is
very
a lot of fun, too.
Yeah.
So, great
interview.
Lots to do at the IMA. Thanks.
Yeah, very fun. Hey, if you can't wait for the holiday season, well, maybe
this
weekend. Worth checking out. As part of Spirit and Place, the Sweet Dreams are made of these. It's a dream-inspired dances from Act Two of The Nutcracker with narration by Rita Cohn, and it's being performed by the Indianapolis School of Ballet at the Central Library. It's free, and again, it's part of Spirit and Place. It's from 2 to 4 o'clock on Sunday the 15th at Central Library, and you can more information when you check, when you click on Spirit in Place for all the great events that are still going on through this weekend with Spirit in Place.
This is not a Spirit in Place event, but it does involve dance. You Theater Sword of Wisdom is this Saturday night at 8 at Clues Memorial Hall. It's Taiwan's You Theater. It presents dance and drumming as high art, powerful, tranquil, dramatic. Picture martial arts combined with drumming. Just almost indescribable. You'll just have to go check it out this Saturday night at 8 at Clues.
Very cool. And, of course, you can always learn more about other local arts events at indiearts.org/guide, the Arts Council of Indianapolis's Indie Arts Guide website, or listen to Cher and I next week on that calendar that we call
What'll We Do?
You're listening to The Art of the Matter, a weekly show about the arts in Indianapolis and Central Indiana. Your hosts are Sharon Gamble and Travis DiNicola. If your arts organization has an event or activity of which you think we should be aware, please contact us at least 3 weeks in advance. You can write us at The Art of the Matter, care of WFYI, 1630 North Meridian Street, Indianapolis, Indiana, 46202. Or you can email us at artofthematter@wfyi.org. You can also hear The Art of the Matter on WFYI.org.
Those who have read writer Dan Carpenter's pleas for justice, equality, and fairness over the years in Indianapolis Star will readily recognize that same voice in Dan's newest book of poetry, The Art He'd Sell for Love. Sharon Gamble invited Dan to talk about how he discovered he was a writer, how poetry differs from prose, and how poems come to him.
So I'd like to ask you to start by reading the poem that I think of as the title poem. I don't know if you think of it that way or not. You're the author, but Art and Living.
Art and Living. I love your story, she says, but I'm wondering, the old couple, do they ever, like, get together? The answer's not in the story, he answers, college boy sage, but in the reader of it. As she smiles and nods, content to indulge him, he's in his own story, picturing his gifted hands raising her coat collar, brushing her cheek, wondering how cheap he'd sell this art, these words, scattered like seed at their feet.
So, have you ever thought of your writing as currency? Is it, in fact, something by which you, something that you buy or sell for experience or for some kind of gain?
Fundamentally, I write, as I suppose most people do, to be noticed and to have my existence validated, and beyond that, maybe to really impress people. And there's no question, especially in the case of the younger persona of Art and Living, that you'd love to win somebody else's affections with it. So there's not much of a hang-up on my part as to the purity of art. And exactly what I'm trying to gain by it is often impossible to measure or to discriminate. But I don't kid myself that there's ego and there's some hope for gain beyond the art for art's sake.
Sure. Do you remember how you figured out, I assume fairly early in life, that there was power in words?
Definitely. And when I was in high school in particular, that's when I got the bug for journalism, because I found that, as just about the smallest and least fashionable and least athletic kid in my high school, I could, gain some fame and some status with little articles in school newspaper.
Hmm.
Not that many people could write well, just as not that many people could throw a spiral with a football.
Mm-hmm.
And so I latched onto that as as a way of, it's funny, not so much distinguishing myself from the crowd as being part of it.
Oh, you found that was your niche. That allowed you to fit in.
You know, a little marginal place among the cool people. At least I could do that.
Did you go to school in Indianapolis?
Yes. St. Patrick's on the south side, mm-hmm. Fountain Square for grade school, and mm-hmm. then the old Cathedral High School a few blocks from here.
All boys at the time?
All boys at the time.
Yeah. And pretty good size, so you had a lot of classmates.
Yeah, it was. It was maybe 700 or 800.
Yeah.
And, you know, a very good school. It was almost entirely staffed by the Holy Cross Brothers. And that's a phenomenon that's passed away.
Right.
Very strong academically and crazy about football.
Mm-hmm.
And we had I was, of course, from the near south side, and the elite guys, the cool guys, were mostly the north siders. And these are the ones that we tried to keep up with and hoped to get to sit next to at lunch.
Hmm. Did you have a mentor among the faculty or maybe an upperclassman who said, hey, dude, you can do this. Let me show you how.
Several of the English teachers, Brother Carl Schank, I remember, who was really feared for for the rigor of his classes, but I think took some pity on me and encouraged me about my writing. There was an algebra teacher named Brother John Aubrey, who was a Renaissance man into classical music and all this sort of thing, and made mathematics comprehensible to me and even enjoyable. And
wish I'd had one of those.
Oh, really? Because you know he turned me into a B student in mathematics, and that was he may have gone to his grave not realizing it was his greatest achievement. Yeah, but some wonderful guys there, and that sort of teacher in that religious community it no longer exists.
Right. So it's one thing to discover that you have a talent for something. It's another thing to figure out where to apply that talent. And was there a moment where you said, well, this is clearly what I meant to study and to do for a living?
Well, probably by early college. I had settled on the default profession, I guess you'd call it, of newspapers. Because newspapers back then were major employers, and they were kind of printing money compared to the troubles that they're in now.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't see myself as a broadcast candidate, although I've always envied and pined about what you guys do.
Really? Why?
Yeah, I just think that dimension where you have the assembly of words and information and the voice and that immediacy and that drama, that life that it gives to words. I've always kind of had a yearning for that, but print media seemed to be, you know, the best fit for somebody who, you know, fairly shy and retiring and not gifted with a Robert Siegel voice, and was in my case, you know, I had learned from newspapers and that authoritative and succinct and rhythmic style of writing
mm-hmm.
really grabbed me.
And a newspaper is, not sure which tense, hopefully both tenses, a voice that helps shape a community that employs or contains the memory of a community.
Mm-hmm. There was that attraction to the feeling that you could have that kind of influence. And as I got more and more political going to college in the 60s, and working, as we've discussed this before, working in the black press right after college,
mm-hmm.
I became really, you know, really zealous about, you know, righting wrongs and influencing policy.
Sure.
And celebrating people who were really active in politics, active for social change at you know, much greater risk than a writer is.
Right.
Just being able to hold them up.
Give them a voice.
Yeah.
So that's a very different way to use words than poetry, or is it?
Again, perhaps fundamentally not so much. I think one essential difference is the size of audience. Poetry can be very political. It can be an advocacy medium without losing its aesthetic integrity or whatever you want to call it. I mean, poets and critics debate that, whether the art form should be put to the service of anybody's political agenda. But poetry can do its job of beauty and also press for social change. But it's not going to reach that many people, and most of those that it reaches are going to be members of the choir anyway. And this particular book is mostly personal reflections, and those tend to be pretty much apolitical, to the extent that, you know, Etheridge Knight used to say, you walk down the street and somebody says good morning, and how you answer is a political act. You can go to that extent.
Sure.
But newspaper work, advocacy journalism can be literature in itself and is more free to push for changing the world in specific ways. Without figuring that it's compromised its aesthetic or whatever.
Mm-hmm. Would you read for us Reading Rilke, Paying Respects, which is page 22, please?
Rilke's a favorite of mine, and I'm still trying to comprehend him.
Mm-hmm.
I gotta admit that he's out of my stratosphere. I should precede this one. I hate when poets do that. One of his more famous poems is the Archaic Torso of Apollo. Which ends with the line, "You must change your life." And this one is called Reading Rilke, Paying Respects. I shall carry to my grave the art of dead dentists, men who displayed plastic skill as humbling to my own craft as their trade, alongside medicine or sculpture, was to them, in the eyes of those who dreaded their presence, yet rejoiced in their restoration of beauty, their banishment of pain. Gone now, one of them bereft for decades of the precision and stamina gifted him for gifting me, one a suicide, inexplicably, his playful little boast about that perfect crown as enduring to me as his handiwork. Gold and putty, rods and china, an Irish kid's ill-born mouth, outliving fate, merit, the makers of miracles, and one day the host himself, monument and brother to the dead, who will leave a piecemeal Apollo that changed his life.
A good many of the poems in this book seem valedictory to me, as though you're starting to settle some accounts.
Yeah, maybe that's maybe another word for that is senescence. I don't know. But I did find myself. I chose from this scads of poems I've accumulated over the years for this fairly small number, and they did seem to keep coming back to a kind of a closing testament, or as you say, valediction. And I notice also there's not a lot of cheerfulness in most of them.
Did that surprise you after you said this one, okay, here's the book?
Yeah, and maybe it comes down to catharsis. I did find that depending on what mood I was in when I was pulling things together, I did from time to time come up with pieces that were a little more sportif or playful.
Yeah, your tribute to Paul Simon is very playful.
Well, that one, yeah, that one was a lot of fun, and maybe it's significant that the poem is made up almost entirely of stolen lines from somebody else. You know, I should make that a habit. I should be the weird Al Yankovic of poetry.
Sharon Gamble with writer Dan Carpenter. Dan's new book of poems is called The Art He'd Sell for Love, and it's available on Amazon. You can also read Dan's work at IndianaForefront.com. That's IndianaForefront.com, TheStateHouseFile.com, and SkyBlueWindow.org. Thanks for joining us today. The music for today's show is courtesy of the Bocelli Wallrap Jazz Orchestra from their Heart and Soul album, available through Owl Studios at owlstudios.com.
Please listen to The Art of the Matter next week, Thursday at 8 p.m. and Saturday at 7 a.m., when I'll get a preview of Footlights production of Babes in Toyland.
Yay! I'll find out what the University of Indianapolis Jazz Program is up to.
And I'll get a sneak peek at the Stutz Holiday Open House, and we'll have that arts calendar we call
What'll We Do? So please listen next weekend to The Art of the Matter here on 90.1 WFYI Public Radio.
You've been listening to The Art of the Matter, a weekly show about the arts in Central Indiana and Indianapolis. Your hosts are Sharon Gamble and Travis DiNicola. Today's show was edited by Melissa Davis and produced by Travis DiNicola. The Art of the Matter, made possible by the ongoing support of listeners like you.